yeah, we don't have the documentation, but we're American. My birth certificate might not say that, but I love this country. And the idea of moving back to Mexico is just unimaginable. And I think right now what I could do is just advocate for people like myself and to just shine a different light on what people think an undocumented immigrant is.
That's America Arias, an undocumented immigrant who works here in Los Angeles. She was brought to the United States when she was 9 years old. President Obama protected people like her from deportation with an executive order signed back in 2012. President Trump could rescind that order. Coming up, a conversation with her and another dreamer about what they would do if that happens. But first, a federal judge in Washington state issued a legal challenge to the president's travel ban on Friday, meaning President Trump just got checked and balanced. Now, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in California will decide whether the ban should be suspended while legal issues are worked out. The case could very well reach the Supreme Court, which still has only 8 justices. And the stakes in this case are high, especially with the president questioning the authority of the courts on Twitter. To help us understand the ins and outs of how the judicial and executive branches intersect is Adam Winkler, law professor at UCLA. Welcome back, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin at the beginning. The president issues this executive order banning immigrants and refugees from 7 countries. And since then, it has been quite the judicial roller coaster. First, what happened in Boston?
Well, a U.S. district judge, Nathaniel Gorton, he's in Boston, and he declined to extend a temporary injunction against the travel ban on Friday. Gorton said that the ban did not specify certain countries, but didn't discriminate specifically against Muslims. Other courts, however, have said that even though the law is not discriminatory on its face, it's still in doubt because it was motivated by religious discrimination, and they've looked to statements by Trump advisors like Rudy Giuliani to that effect.
Okay, so after he issues that decision, then is that superseded by the decision coming out of Seattle, which institutes a nationwide restraining order?
Well, trial court in Seattle can't supersede or overturn a ruling by a judge in Boston. So the two orders do conflict on some level. The judge in Boston said that Trump's immigration policy was likely to be upheld, while the judge in Washington said it was likely to be invalidated. But this kind of thing does happen sometimes. Different courts see the law in a different way. And ultimately, that's why we need the Supreme Court eventually to step in and provide that kind of national uniformity.
Well, before that happens, it has headed to the Ninth Circuit. So what's going to happen there, or what could happen there?
Well, we're waiting to hear what the Ninth Circuit will do. It's important to recognize that the courts are not now going to rule on the merits of Trump's immigration policy. Rather, what they're doing now is debating whether Trump's policy is likely to be constitutional or likely unconstitutional. And if it is one of the other, the court will determine whether to put a halt to the immigration orders pending that final resolution.
Okay, so as you say, it's likely to get to the Supreme Court. So whichever party loses before the Ninth Circuit will then automatically appeal to the Supreme Court?
I would expect an appeal to go to the Supreme Court. There might be some procedural steps to take beforehand, such as petitioning the entire Ninth Circuit, not just the 3 judges, but the entire 20-member court to weigh in. But yes, at the end of the day, this is likely to go to the Supreme Court to determine whether these orders will be put on hold pending a final resolution.
And then if there are still just 8 justices on the Supreme Court, if Judge Gorsuch is not approved in time, then it is likely, if there is a split decision, then the Ninth Circuit decision remains in place, correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. The way it works, the Supreme Court needs 5 members, a majority, to overturn a lower court ruling. If the court splits 4-4, then the lower court ruling is affirmed. So what the Ninth Circuit does here may be the final word for a while, at least.
Okay, well, let's get briefly into the constitutional arguments on either side. The Trump administration is saying, look, we have broad authority in the executive branch to make policy regarding national security, to keep Americans safe. And is that true?
Well, it is true that the president does have a lot of authority over immigration and over national security measures. In the immigration laws, Congress has given considerable policymaking authority to the president, including the determination of closing the borders for particular reasons. Yet the president must exercise that authority consistent with existing federal law and with the Constitution. And both the federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and the Constitution in the First Amendment prohibit religious discrimination. And there's also issues of international treaties which could affect the ability of the president to, say, reject refugees.
Okay, I don't know if you read the op-ed by John Yoo in the New York Times today. It's called Executive Power Run Amok. And when he was in the Justice Department under President George W. Bush, he was a big fan of executive power and wrote all sorts of legal briefs supporting President Bush's expansion of legal power, executive power, and was also supportive of President Obama's expansion of executive power. But he says that this instance, Donald Trump has gone too far. And that is because the ability to set laws and regarding immigration, that is a power that is vested in the Congress, not in the executive branch.
Well, Congress has vested much of that power in the president through legislation. But it's really telling about how broad and expansive these Trump orders are in terms of executive power that John Yoo, maybe the leading proponent of expansive executive power in America before the Trump administration, thinks that the Trump people have gone too far here. It just shows you how aggressive these measures really were.
And then when we're talking about the motivations, and you mentioned earlier that various courts have looked at what Donald Trump has said, maybe in his Twitter feed or in interviews about wanting to ban Muslims, do courts generally look at outside statements, or do they look at the order itself, the actual words written on the paper?
You start with the words written on the paper, but the Supreme Court has made it clear to the courts that the Constitution does not allow certain forms of discrimination, whether that discrimination is done overtly and explicitly or whether it's done covertly and quietly. And they will look at statements that show that there was some kind of racial or, in this case, religious motivation. Those kinds of statements are directly relevant to the case at hand.
And is that, do you think, going to be the determining factor?
I think it will be one determining factor. I think it's going to be a very influential issue in how the court rules on whether these executive orders violate the First Amendment or Religious Freedom Restoration Act. There are other issues, such as the prohibition on refugees, that might turn instead on international human rights treaties and not on the Constitution or on the motivations behind the ban.
Adam Winkler is a law professor at UCLA. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the sound of 19-year-old Abdullah Al-Rifai being greeted by his family at LAX yesterday as he arrived from Jordan.
Hey.
I can't hug you.
Abdullah Al-Rifai is Iraqi, but he had been studying here at Glendale Community College on a student visa. Last month, he went back to Jordan to renew his visa. It's where he and his family have lived for most of his life because, well, Iraq is too violent these days. But then last weekend, President Trump's executive order said no Iraqis could enter the country for a while, and Abdullah was stuck in Jordan. Here, there were protests and court decisions. And finally, on Friday, a judge in Seattle put the entire executive order on hold. Abdullah was free to return to Los Angeles. He's back. He's here on the line now. Welcome.
Hey.
Welcome back. And that,
thank you. Good to be back.
That sound that we just played at the top of this piece, yeah, that was from yesterday, right?
Yes, that was from yesterday. The moment I arrived at LAX. It was really emotional, but I'm mostly happy and grateful to be here.
Yeah. So tell us about the last week. What was it like for you?
It was a crazy ride, honestly. Let me take you back to the moment I found out that President Trump signed the executive order to ban these seven countries. So I was surfing through Facebook, I guess, and I stumbled upon this news, and it was kind of a shock at the beginning because I thought, but wait, that's a big thing. Is he actually going to do it? Then when it got confirmed and everything, and I started seeing people being sent away, I panicked. It was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what to do. It's like my whole life just turned upside down.
Because you had been studying, what are you studying at Glendale Community College?
Mechanical engineering.
Uh-huh. And how long had you been here?
I'm going to begin my third semester in 2 weeks.
Okay.
So it's basically a year.
Okay.
And I just got used to living here. I have my apartment with my roommates and all of my stuff here. I didn't even take all my stuff back to Jordan because I was there for only 1 month to renew my visa and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
So I renewed my visa, and President Trump literally signed the order after my visa got renewed by like 2-3 days.
Wow.
So it was panic, hysteria, you can say. I started thinking of other options, honestly. I almost applied to universities in the United Kingdom.
Huh.
Because I thought I would never get to go back. And to be fully honest, my roommates said the same thing. They're like, hey, we don't think Abdullah's coming back. This is really heartbreaking, but we should do something about it. And they're gonna make the college sign a petition. I don't know. They were just excited, like a petition to get me back. I don't know.
Yeah. And how long did it take for you to get your student visa in the first place? And what did you have to go through to get it?
Nothing much, honestly. I took it. It came out in like 1 week.
So it wasn't hard for you to get cleared as an Iraqi citizen to get cleared to come to the United States to study?
Not at all.
It wasn't hard?
No.
Okay. So then you find out that on Friday, the judge in Seattle has put a stay on the executive order. It said,
right,
this can't go through. And so when did you then decide to get on a plane?
So my original ticket, the one I have for returning here, is February 5th, right? Yesterday, right?
Yeah.
Sunday.
Yeah.
So, and the order, the judge's order, came out last Friday, right?
Correct.
So what we did, what my father did, my father saw the judge's hold, and he decided to act. So we got a new ticket, like a ticket that would fly me immediately the same day. We didn't want to wait till February 5th.
Mm-hmm. Just in case.
Just in case, exactly. So so my dad literally woke me up. He told me, yo, your plane isn't like, it's leaving in 2 hours. Pack your bags, get ready, we're going out right now. It was like, it was chaos everywhere. I'm just taking stuff and putting them in the bag. I don't even know what I'm taking. Yeah. And so we went to the airport. I went to the check-in counter. I was all set. I have all my papers, everything. And a guy there called an official from America, from here, and he told him that, no, we're sorry, but we're not going to let him in.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, but wait, this is the judge's hold and everything. We can go back now. He's like, I'm sorry, but the airlines haven't received any orders. So when I came back from the airport, I immediately called my airline, the one I'm supposed to return on February 5th. And they told me that we received instructions. We are letting everyone in, and everyone is getting through in the U.S. So I'm like, hey, great. I'll just wait for my original flight and then go back. And I did.
Wow. So you had maybe a tense Saturday when you were waiting to see if the ruling would be overturned or whatever.
Yeah.
But it does illustrate your experience at the airport. It does illustrate the confusion. Mm-hmm. The worldwide confusion that has
everyone's
happened.
So confused. They're so confused. I even called the airport to ask them about this. They're like, hey, we have no idea what's going on right now.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, you're here now, so that's good.
Yeah, that's really good.
And so are you afraid to travel now?
Well, now? Yeah, honestly. Yes, it's because I might not get in.
Right.
If I came back. So my strategy is to wait it out for the summer until my semester ends. and then maybe I'll go back or just stay. I don't know.
But what do you want to do?
Well, my parents are supposed to come here visit when my semester ends. So that's the best case scenario with them getting here.
And for the longer term?
For the longer term, I want to stay here and finish everything. You know, I'm in a college now. I want to transfer to university.
And become a mechanical engineer?
Yes, hopefully.
And live here or somewhere else?
No, I might want to go somewhere else. Or I might work with my dad in his company.
Yeah, in Jordan?
Yeah.
So has this at all soured your feeling for America? You, it must be said that I found out about your story through your cousin, who's a writer at the LA Times. She wrote a story about you, Lorraine Ellie, and she said that you are fanatic for American popular culture.
No, my feelings haven't changed for America because this is the act of a single man. This is not the act of an entire country. This doesn't represent America, and I know that. What actually represents America are the protesters that are protesting against this decision. So, yeah.
Well, welcome back, and I'm glad you made it through.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's Abdullah Al-Rifai. He's a 19-year-old Iraqi student. He's studying at Glendale Community College. Coming up, the argument for why Apple should be responsible for preventing texting while driving. A new lawsuit is trying to force Apple to install software that would do that. We'll have that story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Most of us have done it before, maybe just once, texted while driving.
Sometimes when things clear away, you're not watching it, you're in your car, and you start going, oh, no, here it comes, that I am alone, like it starts to visit on you. You know, just the sadness.
Yes.
Life is tremendously sad just by, you know, being in it. And so you're driving, and then you go, that's why we text and drive. I look around, pretty much 100% of people driving are texting.
Yes.
That's Louis C.K. talking to Conan O'Brien there. Jokes aside, texting and driving is really dangerous. It causes hundreds of thousands of accidents every year. So if texting is irresistible to so many people, maybe because of that sadness Louis C.K. was talking about, what can be done to stop people from doing it? If laws banning texting while driving don't work, what could work? Well, a class action lawsuit filed recently says maybe Apple should be taking more responsibility for drivers' risky behavior. Jonathan Michaels is one of the attorneys who filed the lawsuit. He's a founding member of the firm MLG Automotive Law in Newport Beach. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. It's very nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And also joining us, Adam Zimmerman, professor of law at Loyola Law School, where he specializes in class actions, mass torts, and administrative law. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you, too. Well, Jonathan, let's begin with you and tell us about your lawsuit. How did it come about?
Well, for quite a while, we have seen the texting and driving as one of the most serious problems that our society faces. And it's a problem that really is getting far worse than better. And, you know, we have all seen that there are certain things that legislatures are trying to do to prevent the practice. And it really is not having any effect in any material way of preventing the practice from happening. So what we have done is we have gone against the cell phone manufacturer to force them to actually have a lockout device that would prevent texting and driving for all drivers and in this crazy epidemic.
So Apple actually has that technology available, but it just hasn't installed it?
Many people will be surprised to learn this, but back in 2008, Apple itself applied for a patent with the U.S. Trademark Patent Office for a lockout device. So it's had the technology since 2008. In 2014, it was actually granted the patent. So it has this technology, and it just simply refuses to use it on its phones.
And how would it work exactly?
Well, when the car starts moving, the phone would essentially not allow the user to engage with it. You know, it's a complete lockout for any texting, any Facebook, any streaming while the driver is in a motor vehicle.
So I understand the plaintiff in your case was rear-ended by a woman who's texting.
That's correct.
Why not just sue her for damages?
Well, there's two separate issues here. One is the injury that he has suffered as a result of this, but there's really a much larger issue that affects all of us here in California, and really all of us in the nation, which is this is an epidemic that is really growing. And so in our view, something needs to be done to prevent this. Legislating against the drivers is not having the kind of impact that we really need. And so he decided to take a stand and to do something about it, not only for his benefit, but really for the benefit of all Californians to stop this practice.
All right, let's bring in Adam Zimmerman now from Loyola Law School. And what do you think about this? Does he have a good argument? And is it possible to actually sue the manufacturer of the cell phone in cases like this?
Well, let me take that in two parts. I mean, I think it's a very interesting argument because it just kind of reflects this broader trend. You know, like smartphones and fitness trackers and automated car systems have become so good at influencing and tracking how we act, you could make the argument that manufacturers arguably know more about us and how we use their products than we know ourselves. And you could say that knowledge raises new questions about what kind of harms the companies who make these devices should be held accountable for. And we've seen, not just in this case, but in lawsuits against Garmin for a faulty GPS system and Snapchat for an app that would apparently encourage speeding because you could kind of see how fast you're going and people would share their Snap app, that there have been increasing lawsuits not just against someone who's speeding or maybe against the manufacturer of a car, but against a technology company because they're in this position to possibly know about the potential for harm and even track that behavior. There are some hurdles to bringing these types of cases. You know, this case is brought under an unfair competition law in California, which is a really powerful weapon. In California, you can sue a company for engaging in unfair and unlawful and fraudulent conduct in connection with virtually any kind of business activity. And you can seek really broad equitable remedies under this unfair competition law, including an injunction like the ones being sought here. But there are a lot of defenses that you could imagine Apple might bring that they'll have to overcome in a case like this.
Well, by unfair competition, Jonathan, are you saying it's because Apple dominates the smartphone market and so that's why you're suing them?
No, absolutely not. Let me address two issues that you raised there. The reason that we're suing under the unfair competition law is we believe that Apple's practice of selling phones to the public when it has a lockout device that it refuses to use constitutes an unfair business practice as it's defined under California law. And so that's really the legal basis for it. The reason that we're going after Apple is the conversation starts with Apple, but it doesn't end with Apple. We believe that if Apple is forced to make the change, that Samsung and Google and all the other players will eventually engage in the same type of lockout device.
Okay, so back to you, Adam. What do you envision Apple's argument to be?
Well, I think that, I mean, I can see them making a few different arguments. So one is basically rooted in one of the first questions you asked, which is, well, maybe there's some type of obligation on behalf of the user of the product. You could imagine someone saying that either the driver is the proximate cause of the harm, they're the true cause of the harm when they're using the phone like this, or that a user of the phone might be assuming a certain amount of risk when they're knowingly and voluntarily doing this. And what's interesting about the plaintiff's complaint here is they've brought in, and you yourself, in kind of playing that clip of Louis C.K., you're bringing in, like, there's actually something innately psychological and unconscious about the way that we use cell phones in our lives, and that a typical type of defense that someone assume the risk of certain types of behavior in a car, you usually have to show that that person knew or were doing it voluntarily. You could say that a lot of people use their phones on the freeway almost out of this kind of unconscious biological urge.
It's but just is that Apple's fault? I mean,
well, that's the interesting question that would be presented here. So the first thing Apple would say is that it's not our fault; it's the fault of the users. But to the extent that manufacturers of products are in this increasing position to not just sell these products in a way that people can use them in this way, but also because Apple's in a position to kind of know it, to actually know this behavior and develop mechanisms to ameliorate it, you can imagine an argument being made that maybe they have some type of obligation there. There's a couple of other hurdles, though. Another might be that the court has to kind of balance, like, the practice's impact on the alleged victim balanced against whatever reasons or justifications or motives might be for Apple to have a phone like this. So Apple has an option, you know, to limit your ability to use the phone, but they haven't locked it out. And you can imagine them making justifications for someone to not be locked out while they're driving. You can imagine Apple asserting that as a potential defense. Hmm. And then the third defense that I imagine is just this question of who gets to decide this. So some courts have said that, you know, when you have a challenge business practice and the practice hasn't been prohibited yet, the courts shouldn't do what a legislature or a responsible regulating agency should do. What's unclear here is how much that argument would apply to something like this. Like, phones and mobile technology are so new and they're evolving so fast, it's not quite clear it's already heavily regulated. And, you know, sometimes when you have issues like this that are so new that legislatures and regulators aren't able to act quick enough, those cases fall through the cracks. And that's sometimes where our court systems provide a backstop, you know, for people to raise these issues. And I mean, my feeling is even if they lose, they win. Like, I think that just by raising the salience of these issues, hopefully we can trigger a response from our regulators and from our legislatures about better ways to kind of regulate phone use in cars.
Well, Jonathan, there are regulations, there are laws. You're not supposed to text while you're driving. And now there's a law in California that says you can't even have the phone in your hand, no matter what you're doing while you're driving. And it doesn't seem to have done anything.
And that's exactly our point, is that legislating against the driver is simply not going to have any impact. And that's a fact that Apple has itself acknowledged. Interestingly, when they filed for the patent, part of their application actually states that legislating against the driver is not likely to eliminate the dangerous practice of texting and driving. And in fact, that has proven to be true. And they have the ability to prevent it. They're allowing this business practice to continue while knowing that scores of people are being injured and killed.
So as Adam said, even if you lose, do you win?
I think we do. Look, we're not asking for Apple to give us $1 billion. We're not asking for any money, as a matter of fact. We're asking for the courts to stop this particular practice. And our goal is to bring awareness to this. And it's our hope that we create a new normal for our society in this regard.
All right. Jonathan Michaels, attorney and founding member of MLG Automotive Law. Adam Zimmerman, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think Apple should be forced to implement its driver lockout technology, or should it be up to drivers like you and me to follow the law and to control ourselves? Comment on our Facebook page or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, migrants discard objects along the border when they come here. Those objects tell a powerful story.
You know, most people talk about the things we find on the border as trash, but, you know, each one is a person's soul, if you will.
The photographer's discoveries next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump's head of Homeland Security has vowed to finish the wall between the United States and Mexico by 2019. The wall would span nearly 2,000 miles over desert, mountains, and rivers, a forbidding topography that photographer Richard Mizrach has been exploring for years. His photos of the borderlands are the subject of a book called Border Cantos, and Richard Mizrach joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, Canto, nice to have you. A canto is a section of a poem. It also means song in Spanish. Is that how you see your work, as a poem?
Well, for years, since the late 1970s, actually, I've been working in groups or chapters, if you will, and I've called them the cantos because they're not only independent photo essays, but they link together. So they create kind of an epic project. And so there's now about 40 cantos spanning the last, you know, 30 plus years.
And do each canto, does it take on a particular section of the border?
No. It takes on the American West, American Desert West. So I have cantos that talk on about man-made fires, man-made floods, the nuclear test site, military bombing ranges, space shuttle landings. And the border is kind of the most recent installation. There's eight cantos in there. So each canto is devoted, for example, on the border, there's eight cantos, and one is devoted specifically to the wall. Another is called The Artifacts. That is migrant belongings that we found along the border that I photographed and brought back for my partner Guillermo to turn into instruments. And there's water stations. These are where humanitarian groups put out water for people coming across the desert, and they do that in California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. And so I have a canto called Agua, which is mm-hmm. what's written on these water stations that are in the middle of nowhere.
There's one photo that was particularly striking. They're all striking, but this one really took my breath away. It's of three stick figures and dressed in clothing, and I guess they're effigies.
Yes, yeah, so that's a canto called The Effigies, and that's one of the first cantos, which I made in 2009. And along the California-Mexico border, along these gullies along the border, I found these, for lack of a better word, scarecrows or effigies made from migrant clothing that were left along the border that were placed by an anonymous individual on agave plants all along the border. So there was maybe 20 of them. So I did a series of photographs of those. They were so powerful, it was really hard to tell what they stood for, whether they were an art project, whether they were warnings to migrants that are about to come over the border, whether they were protests against the Border Patrol. The fact that they were really dark and disturbing and haunting, but you didn't know what they actually meant. I thought I'd leave it that way because that's the way I found them.
But isn't that also the theme of a lot of your work? Is this essential mystery that you can't ever really know why a particular object, for example, is in a particular place, or why someone is looking the way they are, or it's just like an essential existential mystery as to why things are, especially along the border.
I think that's actually a good point. The eight cantos that I have in this project, and there's a lot of photographs in each canto, there's no people in them. Sometimes there's some that you can glimmer through the other side of the wall, but they're not portraits. I don't follow migrants across, none of the normal traditional journalism. What I've done is left all these symbols along the border, whether it's the wall or the artifacts or the water stations or the drag tires that the Border Patrol drags to create smooth paths so that they can track people. The absence of people is the presence in these pictures. And for me, it's more powerful because then it allows the imagination to fill in. People are coming through here. We kind of know those stories. But when you just see the landscape and what's going on in the landscape, it allows you to sort of imagine the larger picture.
What is the larger picture that you imagine?
Well, just the terror. I mean, it makes me think about what would it take for me to leave my home and go to another country, leave everything behind, my belongings, family, maybe take, meet some media family, try to cross through this long, treacherous, dangerous area where people could conceivably shoot me or I could die of dehydration. What would it take for me to leave everything? And, the people that come here, 99% of them, they're coming here because they're fleeing something or they're coming here for something better. And it's embedded in all the photographs. If you spend any time with them, it's hard not to imagine that epic drama that must play for every person, every family that endeavors to undertake this form, travel.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Richard Mizrach. His collection of photos from the United States-Mexico border is called Border Cantos. And you said that you work with a guy named Guillermo Galindo. He's a musician. And he makes instruments out of some of the artifacts that you photograph. And I just want to play a little bit of the music that he has composed from one of these artifacts. And Richard, what is going on in this composition?
Yeah, let me give a little backstory. I started photographing the wall and the effigies canto back in 2009. In fact, some pictures go back to 2004. And in 2012, I saw Guillermo Galindo, who was born in Mexico City, but he's a composer that teaches in California. And he was making presentation in San Francisco of a composition that he made. He found objects on the Texas-Mexico border, built instruments out of those, and then performed them. And it was about a five-minute presentation. And I had photographed these effigies, which were like sculptures found on the border, made from things found on the border. So I contacted Guillermo, who I hadn't met before, had him come to my studio, and we've been collaborating ever since. And what we've done is I've been traveling a lot along the border. It's almost 2,000 miles, and I've been pretty much everywhere. And what I've done is when I find things that could be migrant backpacks, water bottles, tennis shoes, or Border Patrol shotgun shells, or a section of the border wall itself, I bring these back, and then Guillermo builds instruments out of them. And so, for example, the exhibition that opens at the Crystal Bridges Museum next month has my large photographs, but also has Guillermo's sculptures, which are actually instruments, and then sound installations as well.
And in that particular piece of music we just heard, what is he playing, or what is the instrument that he made?
Well, that's interesting. So the effigies you mentioned, which, again, imagine scarecrows, you know, agave stalks clothed with migrant clothing. Guillermo was so moved by those sculptures that were on the border that he made an instrument that looks like that. It's made out of clothing that I brought back. It's got a sound box in the chest. It looks like a human figure with his arms up. And there's strings that run across it. And with a bow, he plucks it. He strokes it. He will pound on the chest, and you get this deep rhythmic thing. And that's him performing that particular instrument.
So it's kind of like giving a voice in the form of music to a migrant.
Yes. I mean, Guillermo, and this was kind of a driving force for both of us. Guillermo said that the Aztecs believed that every object has its own voice, has its own spirit. And so, you know, most people talk about the things we find on the border as trash, but Guillermo says they're not. They're, you know, each one is a person's soul, if you will. And so we, you know, when I gather these things and bring them back, Guillermo gives them back kind of that respect and their voice. And so in the many instruments that he's made, you know, it incorporates all these different kinds of objects, you know, ordinary, you know, it could be a tennis shoe, like I said, or a backpack or a water bottle. But he brings out kind of that person's passage, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say you don't photograph people very often. There is a photo of the border, the U.S., the California-Mexico border, and it's the beach, the Tijuana beach. And you can kind of see on one side of the fence figures, and lots of them on the Mexican side. It's pretty much teeming with life. And then then you take it from the perspective of the U.S. side, and it's empty.
Yeah, so this is interesting. This is where the wall runs into the Pacific Ocean on the San Diego border near Tijuana. And the beach on the other side of the wall is just literally filled with people barbecuing, burying themselves in the sand, body surfing, picnicking, you know, just having a blast. And on the U.S. side, because it's so militarized, nobody's on the beach. And in fact, I photographed too close. I got too close to the wall. You're not allowed to be within 100 yards of the wall or 100 feet of the wall. And I didn't know that at the time, and I got in close to photograph. But basically, when you stand back, there's just nobody using this beautiful beach because it's just so militarized on our side. And there's an irony there. I mean, the picture ends up looking like a jail cell. You have little, to describe to the listener, there's vertical bars with spaces in between that were designed to stop flooding and let small animals pass through. Unexpectedly, it reads like a jail cell, and, you know, we're kind of on the wrong side of the jail cell.
Yeah, are we in or out, do you think?
Exactly. That's the question.
Well, have you ever gotten into trouble taking your photographs?
Have I ever gotten into trouble? I've been confronted sometimes. My experience, for example, with the Border Patrol has been everything from those that have been really helpful and really sympathetic and will show me their cell phone pictures or maybe even tell me where to go take a good picture to others that were threatening and saying that the cartel was going to take my cameras and that I wasn't allowed there. And, you know, so it almost ranged by personality. So that was a really eye-opener for me that almost like anything, it's on an individual basis on people respond. But 99% of the places I was entitled to be there. It was either public land or something like that.
And will you keep photographing the border?
Well, I think right now I'm working on a different canto, if you will. Mm-hmm. I'm right in the thick of it, and it's about the election and sort of how that plays out in the American desert. So I've kind of holding off for a little bit, and I want to watch and see what happens. And I suspect that if there's new construction and new things going on down there, that I might go back and return.
Richard Mizrach, he's a photographer. His latest book is called Border Cantos. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And there's a link to some of Richard Mizrach's photos on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, two young people anxiously await to find out what President Trump will do with the DACA program. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We've been hearing a lot about President Trump's travel ban and how it's affecting Muslims. But Trump has said he wants to crack down on undocumented immigrants who are already here, and that could have a far greater impact. If he reverses President Obama's temporary protection for young people who were brought here as children, that could mean some 800,000 people at risk of being deported. Trump has not said what he'll do about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. So these young people are now waiting anxiously to find out the program's fate and their own future. Two of them join us now to share their stories. America Arias came to the United States from Mexico when she was 9 years old. She's now a freelance news producer here in L.A. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And also on the line, Marco, who has asked that we only identify him by his first name. He came from Mexico when he was 7 years old, and he's a student now at Cal Poly Pomona. Welcome to you.
Hi, thank you.
Well, America, let's begin with you. Your father named you America for a reason, right?
He did. We grew up in Mexico. He always wanted to get an education and pursue a career, but quickly realized that in Mexico, an education doesn't get you very far. He grew up a farmer, grew corn, and sometimes we had really bad crops, and all the money that he invested into the harvest, it did not come to fruition. And so he tried going into the bigger cities, finding employment there, and then realized that there were many doctors, lawyers working as taxi drivers. So in order for him to give us the dream that he had for himself, and couldn't make it into a reality, he decided that the only way to do that was to come to the United States and bring us along. And so I was his firstborn, and he named me after his dream to come to America and turn that dream into a reality.
And what was it like coming over here?
It was terrifying for me. I think it was terrifying for all of us. I think now that we've as a family, we're engaging in these conversations, they confess with me that So we got to Tijuana from the little town of Michoacan, where we're from, several hours from Tijuana. So once we arrived there, we locked out. My dad met a guy who he knew from his youth. And so he was now a police officer who, you know, knew a smuggler who can get us through across the border. And so my parents left me with this guy who promised to smuggle us across the pedestrian crossing and then just left us and hoped to God that we would make it into the U.S. safely. And, you know, they confessed to me later that, you know, when they were together, they were like, what did we just do? Is this guy going to smuggle them and then, you know, sell them and traffic them or sell their organs? And they were just, they tried so hard not to let that get to them, but it did. But I, now as an adult and even as a young kid, I think back and I'm like, I knew the gravity, just how immense the situation was and how difficult their situation must have been that they were willing to make us go through that.
And Marco, what about you? Do you remember crossing?
Yeah, so actually, I have a very similar story. I am also from Michoacan, and a small town there. And we, instead of crops, we had a taco stand. We also got here through a smuggler. It was my brother and I. He was 2 years younger. So our parents letting us go to a smuggler, it's kind of a crazy idea now that you think about it. It's like, I would never let my kid go through that. But there was definitely the risk of staying in Mexico, and there was just no improvement. We wanted a better life. So now that I think about it, I'm really thankful for their choices that they did. There was definitely a risk, but look at me now. Like I've gone through so much and learned so much more things over here in America. I remember the day that I actually crossed the border and then came into America, and I specifically remember like seeing a blimp in the air. There was like a Nickelodeon blimp, and I was like, wow, look, this is the stuff you see on TV. I'm actually seeing it here in person.
So when did you decide to register under DACA?
So as soon as Obama decided to do deferred action, I was like, wow, like I really got to get on this. There's new opportunities for me to work. Before that, you would always look for jobs that paid under the table. Or just there was really no opportunity for us. It was always really scary. How am I going to get money to pay for school? All these things. And so as soon as he implemented that that action, I applied for it right away. Waited, I believe it was 8 months for me. And as soon as that came in, I started looking for jobs and just opportunities started coming to me.
And America, what about you?
For me, it was immediately. I remember that day vividly. I was in Fresno. I was already working. And my brother was dealing with a dilemma because he wanted to go to med school. And he wasn't sure. He had already been accepted to a really great med school in Chicago. And he hesitated because he said, you know, I don't have any way of, you know, improving my immigration status right now. If I were to do it, I might get deported or, you know, sometimes you have to get sent back to Mexico for 10 years in order for the process to just continue its course. And he wasn't willing to do that because it's a huge setback. It's a decade of, you know, lost time. And so he didn't know what to do. And then I remember when President Obama just had this impromptu press conference, and I'm in the news business. So as soon as I heard that he was doing it, nobody really knew what he was going to announce. And so it was just a big surprise even for me, someone who's in the news, and I always get the alerts before most people do. And so I turn it on and I call him, and we're just crying our eyes out because it meant that he was going to be able to pursue his dream of becoming a doctor. And we felt that all of our dreams were possible.
But had you felt that you had to keep it private? Was there some shame associated with being undocumented before?
Definitely. I think growing up, people always told me, like my educators, people who were my mentors, they were just like, what part of being undocumented don't you understand? You just don't say it. You keep it to yourself and you go about it as if you were just a regular, you know, Latino woman who's out there trying to make it happen, make things happen, and you make it happen.
There's always those jobs. I always wanted to do better for myself. And the jobs that I wanted to, I recall in high school, senior year, I wanted to go ahead and work at an insurance agency. I went through the interview. Everything went good. But when it actually came down to the paperwork, I remember them telling me, I'm sorry, we can't allow you to work because of your situation. So I had to go like look for a restaurant job where they would pay under the table. A big idea that people think is that, oh, undocumented people do not pay taxes. My family, my parents, all my friends that I know that are undocumented do pay taxes. But we don't get any of the benefits of people who right. have that ability, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, what are you thinking? We don't know yet what President Trump will do regarding DACA, but what are you preparing for, Marco?
So I'm preparing for, if he keeps DACA, great. I'll keep working as hard as I'm working. If he doesn't, great. I'll keep working as hard as I'm working. Nothing's going to change my mentality of my work ethic. I'm going to keep pursuing myself through my education. I'm going to be graduating next year with a degree in computer information systems. I love it. I love it here. I love the United States. So whatever decision he decides to do and actually pass, I'm going to keep being myself and just keep working hard, keep being vocal about who I am, my roots, and helping others who may not feel so comfortable speaking about their situation. So legality-wise, things will change, but we are still who we are.
But what if your actions, you know, call attention to you and immigration officers come to get you and deport you?
We'll face that situation when it occurs. We don't know if it will happen. If it does happen, it'll happen. But we just got to wait and see what happens.
So you'll stay here. You're not planning to go back to Mexico.
No, I am not. No.
And America, what about you?
I'm not going anywhere. I think I made a conscious decision to be vocal about my situation. And when I made that decision, there's no turning back. I am who I am, and I'm not afraid anymore. And I think the huge reason why I decided to finally speak out about my situation was because we have a president in power who has, you know, promised that he would deport anybody who came here illegally, no matter how young you were or whether or not you made a conscious decision to come here illegally. And that includes me. That includes my siblings, and it includes my family. And instead of being afraid and scared about what could happen to me and my family, I think we have to stand up for ourselves and to say, you know, we were We were escaping violence. You know, a lot of people don't talk about cartels who were hitting up my dad for money because he had a small little crop or small crops that he had in a ranch. And so there's a lot of poverty that we were trying to escape. And we're just coming here to escape all that and to build a better future for us. And so what's ahead for me and my family? Standing up for our rights. And yeah, we don't have the documentation, but we're American. Our birth certificate, my birth certificate might not say that, but I love this country. And the idea of moving back to Mexico is just unimaginable.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for sharing your stories with us today.
You're very welcome.
You're welcome.
That's America Arias. She's a freelance news producer here in Los Angeles. And Marco, a student at Cal Poly Pomona. And Julie Myers is here now to share the listener comments. Hello.
Our listeners are so furious with our story about texting and driving in the lawsuit. I treasure our listeners.
I thought they would push a button or two.
Oh, man. They are so mad about it. Okay. So Rafael Gonzalez tweeted us after the story and says, why do we always have to make laws to deal with the dumbest percent of Americans who don't follow basic logic? Ouch. Charles J. Morris III on Facebook said, spun out some hypotheticals for us. Should we start filing lawsuits against beer companies for DUIs? Or should we hold McDonald's responsible for obesity? Do we sue the internet because two little kids stabbed their friend in the name of the Slender Man? Where does it end? ! If you had any question about how emphatic that was. I love it.
No
I love when our
there.
Listeners,
no.
You guys, you're the best. Thank you for weighing in and bring all of your anger on.
Okay. Thank you so much. ! Julie Myers. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.